Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Just inside the entrance to the suite of offices in the Indiana University Athletic Department in Assembly Hall is a large plaque with the names of the people who have served as Director of Athletics. There aren't too many of them. And the newest person to assume that position is Fred Glass, who took over on January 2nd, 2009. Today, he is our guest. Fred, welcome to Profiles.
Thanks, Owen. I appreciate the invitation.
You were graduated from Brebeuf High School in Indianapolis. You've been active in Catholic education. How did you happen to come to IU, a public institution?
Right. Well, I went to St. Thomas Aquinas grade school and Brebeuf Jesuit High School, but I always wanted to go to Indiana University, and I think it was then, as it is now, a tremendous bargain financially, a world-class university right in our backyard, and it was a great opportunity for me, and I was really glad to be able to come here.
You chose political science as a major. Why?
Right. I always wanted to be a lawyer, and I always enjoyed political science and history and those sorts of things. I do better when the answer is not black and white. Math and science were not my strong suits. So if I have a little room to maneuver on an essay or a paper, I probably am better in that environment. Political science gave me the opportunity to write and study about governments, which is really my sort of my passion.
You got an internship in Washington, D.C. when you were here. How did that come about?
Well, I've told this story before, but we're sitting here along 7th Street, and 7th Street comes into play there. I thought I wanted to work for Birch Bayh. He was a hero of mine. I was not maybe the front of the class most focused student, and got a little behind the eight ball and went to my advisor, Reva Christman, fairly late in the process to try to get an internship for the summer between my junior and senior year. And when I got there fairly late, she said, "Hey, you're late. But the good news is there's going to be an internship that Senator Bayh has in place for the fall," which would have been the fall of my senior year. And so that totally discombobulated me and changed my plan. And I said, "Well, there's no way I can do that." And I walked out, and my girlfriend was waiting for me. And I said, "I'm not going to do that. I don't want to miss my senior year in Bloomington. I can't afford it because I would not be able to earn money in the summer because I'd have to go to summer school and blah, 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 blah." And she sort of slapped me around and said, "You're crazy. You need to do this. It's a great opportunity. It's right. It's what you like." It was on the subcommittee on the Constitution as opposed to his personal staff. And she talked me into doing it. And I applied and did it. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience and really got me on the road to pretty much everything I've done since. And my favorite clincher of that story is that girlfriend is now my wife. We've been married for 26 years, and she's continued to challenge me and get me to do things a little out of my comfort zone.
Was that experience important in helping you decide to go to law school?
I already wanted to go to law school. It was important in helping me gain confidence that I actually could maybe be engaged on the government side. For me, there was a lot of smoke and magic about what happened in Washington and what happened in Congress. And what I realized through the internship was there's not a lot of magic. It's all about hard work and trying to get things done. It's real people just trying to get those things done. And I figured if they could do it, maybe I could do it too.
After law school, you clerked for Judge Hugh Dillon. What did you learn from that experience?
Well, of course, he's a wonderful IU person. His family goes way back. He wrote for the school paper here, very engaged in the university, and so I learned a lot about the history of Indiana University from Judge Dillon. In fact, I had no interest in having a federal clerkship. I wanted to get at practicing law, but I was walking through the intern office there in the law school and saw this notice that said, "From Judge Dillon, I'm looking for law clerks, be in the top 10% of your class, law review, and a working knowledge of Indiana University basketball is indispensable." And plus, he was an iconic guy. He wrote the DSEG opinion. He was a classic, great judge right out of Central Casting. And I kind of fell in love with him, and he offered me the job, much to my surprise, and I took it. The unique thing about being a lawyer is easy because they tell you which side to be on, and then you advocate for it. The judge, you really have to weigh it all and decide what the right thing to do is. And so I think that deliberative process and working with the judge was a real benefit to me.
After your law clerking and a few years, you got involved with Birchbeier's son. How did that come about?
Well, when I was in Washington working for Senator Birchbeier, I connected up with some people who were part of the broader Bi political family, if you will. And when he came back in 1985 to run for Secretary of State, it was kind of like the Blues Brothers. You know, they kind of put the old band back together again. And so they brought some of the people who were tangentially involved with Senator Birchbeier as kind of the foundation. And there were probably about a dozen of us that had a dinner and said, you know, let's do this thing. And I was somebody who had gotten to know them through the internship, and that's how I got involved in that, and it sort of went on from there.
Hmm. What do you think you brought to working for Evan Bi? Because I think you were with him for, was it 4 years, in the last couple of years, chief of staff?
Right. Well, the first thing was, there's a lot of pieces of that, but the Democrats had been out for so long that there wasn't really anybody in line. So I started out, my wife was scheduling Evan Bi and scheduling his wife, Susan, and she actually got me involved in driving Evan Bi around all over Indiana. And through those long drives and conversations, I think a certain confidence was developed on both sides. And so I sort of moved up into writing papers and briefing the candidate and doing things that normally a new person of my age probably couldn't do. I mean, geez, he was only 32 when he was elected, which didn't seem that young at the time, but I look back on it and can hardly fathom it. And I was about 3 years younger than him. But because of those unique circumstances, I got to do pretty neat things early on. And so when he actually was elected and asked me to come in from the law firm, it was an opportunity that I think was unusual for a person of my age, but something that I couldn't pass up.
What interested you more, politics or law?
Politics.
Why?
I've just always been interested in how that all works. I mean, I remember being a little kid and reading about the credibility gap and people questioning what President Johnson was doing. And I was like, but he's the president. I mean, why would he do anything that isn't right? And I would read about people saying that the people close to the president weren't telling him the truth, were telling him things he wanted to hear. And I just remember thinking, how could that be? And I asked my dad, I said, how could people be in those positions and not tell the guy that they're working for the truth? And he sort of explained to me how hard it can be, truth to power and people wanting to get what they want more than the bigger picture. And I remember vowing to myself, if I was ever in that kind of role, I wouldn't do that. And as I got older, I can see how hard it is sometimes to say to the emperor that he has no clothes, but how valuable you are if you are confident enough in yourself and your relationship with your principal to do that. So those interactions were always something that I was always interested in. I never thought, growing up as a Democrat in Indiana and Marion County at the time, I never thought I'd have a real chance for significant public service. But, you know, these things go in cycles, and it hit me the right way, and I was a big beneficiary of that.
You actually had some considerable service in the party, one could almost say at the national level, because you were, I think, campaign manager for Bill Clinton in the state in 1996 and national convention delegate that year and four years later. Why didn't you wind up going to Washington?
I never wanted to go to Washington, and I've had some opportunities to do that. A couple things. I really like it here. I want my kids to have a lot of the experiences that I had growing up here. I think it's, in terms of government service, to be chief of staff to a governor, it's so much easier to get things done than going to Washington. And then, so those are sort of the positive things. And I suppose another thing is I'm kind of chicken. You know, I see how that place can just chew people up and spit them out. And it's a real grinder out there. And that's not really what I want to be about.
Somewhere along the way, you got involved in sports, which
right.
doesn't – well, in a way, it connects with politics. It's
right.
competition.
Right.
But what drew you into sports?
Right. Well, I've always enjoyed sports. You know, when I was a kid, there weren't any Xboxes or PlayStations or super competitive club sports, or at least I wasn't good enough to be in them. So when I was a kid, you left at 8 in the morning, you came back at 8 in the night, and you played basketball in basketball season, football in football season, baseball in baseball season. And so I was really active in that. Grew up loving the Hoosiers. You know, we used to pretend like we were the Rose Bowl team, and I love reminding Harry Gonzo and Harold Morrow and others from that team that I was just a little bitty kid. When I was emulating them and pretending to be Jade Butcher or skipping school to go see the 1976 team come back to Indianapolis Airport, undefeated national champions. Or in 81, I got my championship when I was here with Landon Turner and Ray Tolbert and Isaiah Thomas, Randy Whitman, and all the guys. So I grew up really enjoying sports and Indiana University sports in general. My involvement in sort of sports as a community activity or an industry is essentially a historical accident. The only reason that really happened was because my friend Bart Peterson was elected mayor of the city of Indianapolis. And Bart was the deputy chief of staff for me when I was Evan Bayh's chief of staff. He became chief of staff after I left. He was my ticket out. As they say, it's hard to get out until you tell the governor there's somebody else that can come in. He was my guy for that. And we were very close friends, and so I was very active in his campaign. I was his transition director, and he asked me to chair the Capital Improvement Board, which is essentially like the stadium authority in Indianapolis. We would oversee the RCA Dome or Lucas Oil Stadium now, Conseco Fieldhouse, Victory Field, where the Indians play. And so I was there not because I was some great sports genius, but because I had the confidence of my principal. I had the confidence of the mayor. And then in that position, you're the landlord to the Pacers. You're the landlord for the Colts. You are involved in NCAA events that occur there. And so, you know, that's how that started. And I think sometimes people, when they're appointed to government positions, they start to believe that they're there because they're some sort of genius in, you know, transportation or whatever, and they have a sense of entitlement. And I think it's important to remember why appointees are there. And I think it's a strength that I always recognize. I wasn't there because I was the smartest guy or the best sports guy or whatever. But I did have the confidence of my principal. I think I had generally good judgment, and I would ride that as long as it made sense. And then when that was over, you know, I left. And that's what I did. I didn't try to hang on after my time had come and gone.
Indianapolis used to be known as Naptown or Indiana right. No Place. Right. And then it started competing for national championships to get the Super Bowl in town. How did that change come about?
This may be my political science bias or my political science lens, but I really believe it was because we've been blessed with tremendous leadership in Indianapolis. And I go back to Mayor John Barton, who started the Greater Indianapolis Progress Committee, started doing things that may seem fairly pedestrian, like changing streets, one-way streets to encourage downtown mobility. He started the Indiana Convention Center, went to the state legislature and convinced them to build the Indiana Convention Center in Indianapolis. Then, of course, Mayor Lugar followed that. He brought the Pacers downtown. He was the driving force behind Unigov, which was a very important impetus for Indianapolis growing at a time when other cities were deteriorating. Mayor Hudnut, four-term mayor, brought the Colts, built an expanded convention center that looked an awful lot like a football stadium. He claimed, no, this isn't a football stadium. It's an expanded convention center. Well, it looked a lot like a football stadium. That was a great act of political courage for him to do that, set the table for the Colts to come. And then everything started running downhill. Mayor Goldsmith came in and was finished the vision for Circle Center Mall downtown, which is a big deal. Conseco Fieldhouse, the best basketball arena in the country, Victory Field. And then Mayor Peterson follows Barton, Lugar, Hudnut, Goldsmith.
So with that, both sides of the...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I mentioned a Democrat, three Republicans, and another Democrat. We've been blessed with great leadership in Indianapolis. Mayor Peterson does Lucas Oil Stadium, keeps the Colts for 30 years, regular rotation of NCAA Final Fours, expands the convention center dramatically. So we've been the beneficiaries of wonderful, wonderful leadership in Indianapolis.
You've had two of these committees, the Indiana Sports Corporation and Marion County Capital Improvement Board. Okay. What the heck is the Indiana Sports Corporation?
Right. The Indiana Sports Corporation is often copied, but was the initial entity in the whole country that focused essentially tourism marketing on sports. Think of it as a convention bureau focused just on sports. And Indianapolis concluded to make sports a way to sort of punch its economic development ticket. We're not on a navigable waterway. We're the second largest city in the country that's not on a navigable waterway. We don't have mountains. Our attractions, if you will, have to be things we build. The good news of that is we end up owning them. We're not going to have somebody make a decision in Europe that we're going to quit making refrigerators or TVs when we're talking about our convention business, our venues, the things that the city literally owns. So the Sports Corporation helps us do that, mostly around events, We've had the Pan Am Games. We've had the International Sports Festival. We've had national championships, more than so than any city in the country. That generates economic development. And it also generates a quality of life. Knowledge workers have choices about where they want to reside. We want them to want to come to Indianapolis, and sports is part of that. Our symphony is part of that. Our downtown retail is part of that. Our affordable housing is part of that. But it is an important part, both in a micro sense on events and heads on beds and getting people to come, and a broader sense to create the kind of quality of life that attracts and retains the kind of folks we want to bring to Indianapolis.
How did you get some of those other parts of the puzzle? You can't host a Super Bowl or a Final Four, for instance, without adequate hotel space. How do you persuade people to come?
You sort of build it one step at a time, and you also fake it till you make it. You know, we declared ourselves the amateur sports capital of the world when, guess what, we were not the amateur sports capital of the world. It's what I like to call over-the-wall leadership. You know, Kennedy talked about when he said we're going to send a man to the moon and bring him back in this decade. He said it was like in Ireland when kids would throw their caps over the wall, because then they had to climb the wall to go get their caps. And that's what he did with we're going to the moon and back. And that's what Bill Hudnut did when he said we're going to build a football stadium. And then I think that's part of what we're saying when we say we're going to go back to the Rose Bowl, or we're going to get the Super Bowl for Indianapolis. Those are audacious, dream big kind of things, but you got to declare them, I think, and then push yourself to get there. So I think Indianapolis said we're going to be the amateur sports capital. And then a couple of years ago, we said we're going to get the Super Bowl, and we don't have the hotel space now, but guess what? We've got a developer that's going to do it. The convention center is not big enough now, but we've got plans on the table to get that done. And guess what? We've got it. And a lot of people didn't think that would happen.
Now, when you were still head of the Sports Corporation, you didn't get the Super Bowl. Was that frustrating?
Yeah, it was really disappointing because, you know, I drank in my own Kool-Aid on that. I thought we were going to get it. And it was very disappointing because we'd put a lot of effort in there, and we'd done a lot of things nobody had ever done before. We raised all the money that we needed to do privately. There was not a penny of government money in that. Nobody's ever done that before or since. We raised all the money through pledges before we went to the meeting. Nobody had ever done that before. We raised $25 million in about 45 days. That was extraordinary, but we thought it was important to demonstrate to the NFL that a fairly small market had the capacity to get that done. So it felt like everything was sort of in place, and we lost by the closest of margins. It went to four ballots, and we lost by one vote. But Dallas had the same standing that we did in terms of they had built a stadium, which the NFL likes to reward stadiums. And then their package was worth $25 million more than ours was because of the monstrosities, gigantic stadium they're building. So ultimately it ended up being dollars and cents. That was disappointing but understandable. But I do think it laid the groundwork for getting the thing the next year, and I'm really excited about that for our community and our region.
You've picked some music for us to listen to.
Right.
What did you pick and why?
I didn't really get to go through my extensive iPod playlist that my kids have helped me put together. But, you know, I'm a huge John Mellencamp fan. I used to go watch him when he played at the Time Out in his Fred Perry tennis shoes, and I wanted to be just like him. And then as his acclaim grew, I followed him around, and he's a huge fan of Indiana University athletics. So I'd say pretty much anything you might have back there by John Mellencamp would be great.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest today is the athletic director of Indiana University, Fred Glass. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. We've been talking about professional sports and we've been talking about amateur sports. How would you compare a Final Four in men's basketball in the NCAA to the Super Bowl?
I think one dramatic difference is Super Bowl is unabashedly about commercialism and corporate America. One of the things I've understood better after being through the process is the game is obviously the center of gravity, but there's a whole universe of events that is all about entertainment and corporate involvement and, you know, a week's run up to that. It's just a huge production and it's unabashedly commercialized. And I think the Final Four really makes an effort to be as non-commercialized as it can be and generally rejects a lot of that stuff, although it builds up around there a little bit. Two games instead of one game. A smaller venue, although the venues for basketball are getting quite bigger. But yeah, I think that's the biggest difference, yeah, the commercial aspect to it.
You make that interesting reference to the commercialization. There are a number of people who complain that college-level sports have become commercialized, banners, either or video board, contests. Is that a concern, the long-range health of college athletics?
Well, I think it's a concern, and I'm not sure with the health. I mean, you know, it's like Rex Early likes to say, it's a mighty thin pancake that doesn't have two sides. And I'm like everybody else. I mean, if it could be the 60s forever and Assembly Hall's this pristine place where there's no signs and all that, and the games are always at Saturday at 2 and Tuesdays at 6:30 or whatever, like it was when I was growing up, and everything was about Channel 4 and the lady with the mop and the stories about Oscar Robertson, I'd like to live there, you know, I did that growing up. The reality is there's so much pressure to raise the kind of revenues that are necessary without being reliant on tuition or student fees or that sort of thing. The money has to come from someplace. And so the advertising, the sponsorships make it possible to have the kind of programming that we have. And so it's sort of a necessary evil. And it actually enables the programs to be healthier in a way in terms of being able to have rowing, field hockey, water polo, even men's soccer or track and field. We just wouldn't generate the kind of revenues to be able to offer those kind of sports without trying to maximize in a tasteful way revenue on football and basketball.
Are there some long-term problems? I think the Ohio State athletic budget is twice what IU is.
Right.
Is this unevenness going to be worsened by the commercialization?
Yes. Yeah. It's like a lot of things. The richer will tend to get richer, and it'll be more and more challenging for the poor. On the other hand, you know, I like to look at it as we have more opportunity for growth. And I look in that football stadium and I don't have to look very far to see where the revenues are. It'd be one thing if we thought we were an underfunded department and everything was running all cylinders, including football. We're an underfunded department, but we're not running all cylinders. There's a lot of revenue in that football stadium if we can get folks to come to the games. We as you reflect, knowing this by your question, we rank last in the Big Ten in terms of how much we spend per sport. And I was noodling around with those numbers a little bit, and I thought, well, okay, well, where will we need to be to get to the median? And we'd have to add $17 million on a $52 million base just to get to the middle of the pack. That would be very, very challenging and will be very challenging. So the reality is we're going to have to do more with less for the foreseeable future. And we can. I mean, we can be, and we have to be, better, smarter, more strategic. We need to be the PT boat zooming around a couple of these aircraft carriers. And we can do that because we can be more nimble because of our size, and that's what we're going to need to do, and sell our strengths. You know, I like to say we're the Florida of the Big Ten. You know, we're the southernmost campus in the Big Ten. That should help us with baseball and softball and some other things. We're Bloomington, Indiana. You know, we're the quintessential college town. That ought to be better than Columbus and Minneapolis. Of course, they have some advantages because of corporate base and whatnot being in major metropolitan areas. But I think we ought to build to our strengths. It's the Big Ten. It's IU. It's Bloomington. It's Falls down here. It's basketball tradition. So I don't feel woe is me on the things we don't have. I'm really excited about the foundations upon which we can build.
Do the facilities make a difference? Football stadium being remodeled, will that have the kind of impact that, say, Lucas Oil Stadium has had in Indianapolis mm-hmm. compared to the old, what some of us still call the Hoosier Dome?
Right. Sadly, I think facilities do matter. They're not everything. I mean, people are the most important, but facilities help drive the kind of people that you can get. And so I think the commitment that was made to the football stadium was necessary if we were going to take the football program where we needed it to go. If we're going to take advantage of being the floor of the Big Ten, we're going to need to improve our baseball facilities. The basketball development center that's going up right now is critical to us maintaining our position as a national powerhouse program. And there's a bit of an arms race in our conference around the country on facilities. So we need to improve to sort of stay even. And we're gonna work at that. We're gonna do that responsibly, but we're gonna try to bring in the kind of funding that we need, not from the university, but from earning it or raising it to stay competitive with facilities.
How do you fill the football stadium?
Yeah,
a winning team helps, obviously. But...
Right, winning team helps, and we're gonna do everything we can to support Coach Lynch on the competitive side to win, because nothing succeeds like success on the field. But I think it's a cop-out to suggest that we as a department or we as a university can't do anything to drive attendance until the football team wins. I think it's a convenient excuse to say, well, geez, when those guys win, then they'll come and there's nothing we need to do. So I think what we need to do is building on our traditions, start to do some things that make the football the centerpiece of an exciting Saturday experience in Bloomington. Outside the stadium, maybe we have some ancillary events that people enjoy, chili cook-offs, rib fests, just try to make the experience broader and try to get people excited about being in the stadium. I've told our people, let's think big. I want people to leave the stadium and feel like they need to take a nap or a shower or both because they're so worn out from all the stuff that was going on in there that people want to come in and see more interactive cheers with the crowd. Or maybe a kid zone in the south end zone where kids can go in there and interact with some of our players and throw a football through a tire and that sort of thing. Get the band stepping out and doing different kind of wacky things, engagement things on the field. So we're going to try to do some things that get people excited about coming to the games. And candidly, we're going to try to do that in basketball as well. We've got great traditions in Assembly Hall. Like a lot of places around the conference, we're not sold out. We need to drive attendance there and maybe do some things that we haven't done in the past that are tasteful and consistent with our traditions, but exciting.
One of the newer developments, I think, within the conference is the question of student attendance. Indiana has struggled for a long time in football to get students to come out, but it turns out that even in basketball arenas and the rest of the Big Ten, students aren't coming as much. What right. can you do about that?
You know, I think we need to make it an event that they really want to attend that they can't replicate by watching it in their dorm room or at their fraternity house on TV. In some ways, we're victims of our own success because demand was so rabid from students that the department understandably just didn't need to do a lot to make sure people understood about availability and opportunity and all that. Well, we need to get a little sharper on that now, I think, to be not only order takers from a limited supply, but marketers, and encourage people to come and have some promotions, make an experience that people really want to enjoy, maybe shake some things up with how we approach attendance at the games. We've started some of that even yet this year, and I think next year the student body and the supporters of Indiana University basketball are going to see a little bit of a different approach in terms of trying to drive attendance at the games.
In connection with basketball, there are some people who say that Assembly Hall is dated. Mm-hmm. There are others who say Indiana shouldn't be spending money on that when there are other needs. How do you resolve that conflict?
Right. I think a new assembly hall, if you will, is not a short-term agenda item, at least for me. Because of my involvement in Lucas Oil Stadium and the convention center and other things, I think there was some perception that they brought the guy in to do this new facility. That was never mentioned. That's not a hidden agenda or an express agenda. We have a full plate. We're doing the football expansion. We're doing the basketball facility. We're doing the academic center, which is a huge priority for me to make sure that gets done right. And then baseball and softball have been promised. That's a pretty full plate. We need to do some things to tweak our great traditions in track and field, in swimming and diving. So we've got some things that are going to keep us very busy in the short and medium term. Longer term, I think it's something we're going to need to look at, not necessarily because the venue has become obsolete, because the RCA Dome, even though structurally it was great, it became obsolete as a place to support an NFL franchise. Assembly Hall, we have maybe the reverse problem. It's probably just fine as a venue, but it's actually starting to have dramatic wear and tear. We're going to need to start looking at that building in the longer term. Do we continue to put millions of dollars into that building to keep the roof from leaking and all that sort of thing, or do we look at a new facility? Of course, if we do a new facility, that's going to be driven by money that we would raise for athletics. It wouldn't be cannibalizing projects that need to go on campus for academic purposes, and I'm confident that we wouldn't be getting appropriations from the General Assembly.
I don't think anybody is.
Correct, yeah. And even who knows what's going to be going on in the longer term, but we'd have to raise it. So I think if and when we would pursue that, those would probably be dollars that would be uniquely harvested for athletics and not be at the expense of anything else going on around here.
You mentioned the advantage of Bloomington being a modest-sized city in attracting students to come here, but there's not the corporate base of support.
Right.
How do you go about getting corporate money to support athletics in a larger way?
Right. We have to look more broadly at Indiana and then even regionally and nationally of people that have a fondness or an interest in Indiana. Our great benefit is that we produce pretty extraordinary people. I think sometimes, growing up here, I liked IU and all that, but I don't think I really had an appreciation for what a world-class institution that it is. The legacy of Herman B. Wells with the business school and the music school and our international footprint and the great alumni that we produce all around the country. Those are folks that do create a pretty darn good base, and I think we need to pay attention to them to try to keep them connected to their university. So when we have opportunities, whether it's with athletics or the music school or international studies or biotechnology or other things we're trying to promote, that we can reach out beyond Bloomington for our wonderful folks who are doing great things around the country and around the world.
What happens to the other sports you mentioned that the money makes possible to have, things like water polo? What would be your goals for what I guess are now called the Olympic sports?
Championships. I want to win championships. That's my third goal, but it's a very important goal. My first goal is to make sure Indiana University once again becomes known as a place that follows the rules, because we do follow the rules. Because of recent history, I think that's very, very important to recapture that place. Secondly, for me, is academic achievement. I want to be a place where moms and dads want to send their kids because they know they're going to go to class and they know they're going to graduate. Those are the foundations. That's what we've been known for, and that's what we need to be known for again. But as we have those pillars in place, then I want to move on to athletic excellence. I want to win Big Ten championships. It's not good enough for me to compete or, be in the middle. I want to win. I'm a competitive person. I was all fat, dumb, and happy at my law firm in Indianapolis. I didn't come down here to goof around. So I want to give our coaches the tools, our student-athletes the tools they need to be successful, and that's football and basketball, of course. Men's soccer. It's regaining our traditions in track and field and swimming and diving, but it's also field hockey, wrestling. Volleyball is coming up real strong and all the rest. There are things we can do to create a culture and resources to be able to produce Big Ten champions, national champions, and that's what I want to be about.
If you could choose another university and say, that's what I would like IU athletics to be like, which one would you choose?
Well, that's a great question. And it underlines a bit of a point, which is, as a lawyer, I'm always looking for a form. You know, I'm not smart enough to create something brand new. I think the more politically correct term is best practices, but I'm looking to copy off of somebody. So I do look around the Big Ten. I mean, who has the model compliance program in the country? Who has the model academic support program in the country? Who has gone from worst to first in different sports? And those are different places. And we're obviously a public university, and maybe that makes things different than some other schools. But one of the schools I look to is Stanford. Obviously not a public university, but it's a university that has a tremendous academic reputation, yet is competitive in sports. And I like to see what they're doing and how do they handle some of the same issues that we need to handle in terms of demanding a certain kind of kid come here in terms of academic achievement and being responsible in student life. Yet I want to win. And I think there's some models like Stanford. You know, University of Texas has one of the best compliance programs in the entire country. That's counterintuitive to me. I wouldn't have necessarily thought it was them, but they are doing great things down there, and I'm trying to understand that better and learn lessons and bring them back here.
What do you do with a sport like women's basketball? Indiana's a hotbed of basketball. Right. People don't go to high school games as much as they used to. Right. Even though Assembly Hall is not full, they still tend to turn out in fairly large number for men's basketball. Right. But that's not the case with women's basketball. How do you solve that kind of problem?
It all starts with getting a great coach, and that's what we have in Coach Jack. She is unbelievable. And one of the things I've learned already that I probably would have known if I thought about it is, to me, coaching is the key. It's where the rubber meets the road. It's how you really develop your student athletes, both as athletes but as students. Because one of the things that I've come to understand is you can have the best compliance department in the country, but if the coach doesn't stand behind compliance, you're dead. You can have one of the best academic support systems in the country, but if your coach doesn't stand behind it, you're dead. They need to pull kids out of practice, make them, you know, meet with the counselors and all that sort of stuff. So we need to have quality coaches, and I'm very focused on trying to make sure we do that. But to come back around with Coach Jack, we do have that kind of quality coach. And that's how you build, I think, the program. We're starting to win, and then we need to do things to support them, like improve our marketing, drive people to those games. If they come, they're going to come back. We don't have the traditions of an Iowa that has unbelievable history of women's basketball and some other places like that, so we're gonna have to build that on our own.
You have the interesting addition to your title. You probably don't consider it an addition, but part of your title is that you're vice president of the university. What does that mean?
Right. Well, it was very important to me, and when I started talking to people at the university about the job that I really want to be obviously focused on athletics, and that's going to be my ultimate responsibility. But I wanted to engage with the university as well. Partly because I'm just a great guy and, you know, want to do that thing, but really because there's all these resources at this tremendous university that can help the athletic department. And I think the athletic department can help the rest of the university because, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, sports has a certain sex appeal that can help sell other things, shine a bright light on other initiatives going on in the university, you know, reflect well on the university. So that was part of what we talked about, and we thought the vice president title would help underscore that I am about that. And I attend the presidential cabinet meetings, and I look at my responsibilities as being beyond the athletic department, going to the university, and going to the broader Bloomington community. I'll give you a quick example. The first person that I met, reached out to on campus, was Dan Smith at the business school. And I said, look, you've got this world-class marketing department, the Kelly School. We have our challenges in marketing. Will you help me? Will you take me on as a project? And this spring, we closed the deal where we're going to have their consulting academy in the Kelly School give us a professor, 4 MBA students, and 4 undergrads to take us on as a project and review our marketing function, help us with the creative on a marketing campaign for football. And I think that'll help make us all famous because we're going to have this really cool state-of-the-art program that we're not paying for. These kids are going to get to do some really cool things, I think, that they're going to see in action because we're going to use it. And we're going to leverage everybody by working together. So I'm real enthusiastic about being part of the university, trying to break down any walls that have grown on 17th Street between campus and the athletic department and make us all better, I hope.
You mentioned about the importance of academic success for students who are athletes. There are some people who find a conflict between the term student-athlete and the other students, that mm-hmm. the student-athletes are stick to themselves, that they aren't mm-hmm. really students in the way they were when you and I were students. Mm-hmm. Is that a concern?
Well, I think the world's changed in a whole bunch of ways from when we were students. And one of the ways it's changed is the demands that are put on these kids. It's really ridiculous. You know, I mean, when I was a kid in high school, you could play all the sports. And now, if you're not a club athlete in volleyball or basketball or whatever, you can just forget it. And you get weeded out as a competitive player at like 12. And by the time they're in college, it used to be that the football coach might have been the baseball coach and the assistant track coach, and they had some balance and you know, they had a broader view. And now it's like there's five basketball coaches and the assistant coach can't wait to be a coach somewhere else, and so there's pressure on the kids to win. I mean, it's and that's bad, but that's sort of reality. And so there's demands on these kids 24 hours a day. Plus there's cell phone videos and cell phone pictures. I mean, these kids step just 1 foot out of bounds, and their picture can be on YouTube before anything happened. So I don't mean that as an excuse. I just mean it as a little bit of an understanding that it's just not 1968 anymore. You know, it's just different. And you know, I might wish it was 40 years ago, but it's not. So these kids have a lot of pressures, and we need to, I think, support them through our academic support. Again, with coaches encouraging them to be integrated in the classroom. That's part of where academics support and coaching priorities come into play, because if the coaches want them to be engaged with their class, then you know what? They're probably going to be engaged with their class. If their coach is comfortable with them sitting in the back of the room and pulling their hoodie over their face and not interacting with other people, then they'll do that. I think we have the kind of coaches and the kind of kids that are getting engaged, and that's going to be something that we try to drive through the department.
It's interesting you mentioned the cell phones and people possibly stepping over line. Are you concerned about the mediatization of college athletics, the way in which there are these blogs and message boards and all those kinds of things that have made college athletics much more public than they used to be?
I am, and not only in athletics but sort of across the board. I mean, I came out of government politics, and I hated the blogs and the kind of vindictive, hurtful, untrue things that, you know, somebody sitting in their mom's basement can crank out and put on, not only in sports, but I think in society generally. But it's reality, and, you know, the positive side of it is everybody's got a printing press, and it's pure First Amendment and stuff like that. So there's some good parts to it. It's reality. I think it's hard on kids, and sometimes they step out of bounds in a way that they need to be, you know, slapped around a little bit. I mean, there's things you don't do, but there's other things that I mean, as the athletic director of the university, you know, I'm very aware that, you know, I'm 24/7 and I'm only one cell phone picture away from being in hot water, you know, and so maybe that's good, you know, keeps me a little straight. But I think, you know, that's just the reality with these guys, and I think it can drive them to only interact with each other, and sort of understandably so, but we need to work about that to have them integrated in the student body. The other thing I might mention real quickly is our student athletes are people that have these extraordinary skills at an extracurricular, or what a lot of people view as an extracurricular activity, but they're also students. Well, that's not limited to sports. If you look at the Jacobs School of Music, which all of us have a lot of pride about, a lot of those kids have tremendous ability at what some people would consider an extracurricular activity, but sometimes they might not be the best general students. In fact, the special admissions at the university, there's much more music kids in that than there are sports kids. So it's not unusual for the university to try to attract the best and brightest among us in a particular area that may not be entirely consistent with the general student body. And I think we ought to reach out for people like that that can do extraordinary things in music or sports or other things, because I think it enhances the fabric of the campus.
Can an athletic department effectively manage the media, or is the athletic department put in a mostly reactive mode?
Right. Well, that brings up a whole lot of really interesting things. And one of the things I want to do is probably with the help of the journalism school, and I've shamelessly asked them for resources to help us say, are we lined up? Is our organization lined up in a way that's effective in modern media? And we may be, I'm not sure, but it's possible that we're lined up from a print-driven environment, and print journalism is still very important, but the blogs and the Obama texting communication world is here, and are we there? And we need to be. So one issue is whether we're organized in a way that makes us as accessible as we can be to our fan base, which is critical for all different kinds of things. But like everything else, there's a whole bunch of people in that media department that weren't there, 30 years ago.
Let's throw the cap over the wall.
Good.
What would you like to accomplish in the next decade? Where would you like the athletic department and its teams at Indiana University to be?
I would like in 10 years to look back and feel like that the previous decade was the new golden age in Indiana University athletics. I'm 49 years old. I hope to be here till I have to retire at 65. I ain't got nowhere else I want to go. I'm not trying to set the table to get to Stanford or North Carolina or Notre Dame or anything like that. This is where I want to be. It's the only place I want to be. And I hope that longevity can be helpful. I mean, I'm the fifth athletic director in 8 years. That's ridiculous. We're on our third president in that 5-year time. That's tough. I mean, the stability I hope to be able to bring, I think, can in part be the basis for doing what I described, something as audacious as saying a new golden age in Indiana University athletics. And that's not a low bar, because we've done a lot of tremendous things over the years and at different times. But I think if we focus on compliance, academic achievement, and athletic excellence, including coaching, facilities, marketing, and budget, I think we can get here, because it is Bloomington, Indiana. This is the Big Ten. We are Indiana University, and I think that's something we're going to be able to do.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been IU Athletic Director Fred Glass. Fred, thanks for this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. We close with more music chosen by Fred Glass.
How about some more Mellencamp?
For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
See the moon roll across the stars. See the seasons turn like a heart. Father's days are lost to you. This is your time here to do what you will do. Your life is now. Your life is now. Your life.
The program you have just heard was recorded in January of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.